Welcome back to ILTA Voices, your home for all things ILTA.
Welcome everyone to today's ILTA Voices podcast entitled, When Is It Too Much Data? I'm your moderator for today, and my name is Rachel McAdams, and I'm thrilled to be joined by our two distinguished panelists today, Owen and Chris. Owen, do you want to kick off by giving everyone a quick introduction to yourself?
Yep, thank you, Rachel. My name is Owen Kenny. I head up the e-discovery and investigation support unit in a large Irish law firm called A&L Gubbity. My background is I'm a kind of recovering lawyer. I started off as a litigator before moving into the e-discovery world in full sort of 7 years ago. Do you, Chris?
Great, thank you. My name is Chris Acosta. I'm the director of e-discovery resources at Morrison Forster. It's a global law firm, Amwell 50. And I have been with the law firm for about 5 years, been in the e-discovery space for about 17 years. But prior to that, I was in the IT side.
Brilliant. Welcome to you both. And thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sure this is going to be a really interesting conversation, particularly when we have some perspectives from both sides of the Atlantic. So to kick off, my first question is, how do you know when you've got too much data? What does it mean to be proportional? How would you define that? Owen, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in. I actually think it's a really interesting question, and it's one that I think we probably struggle with a bit because we tend to think of it purely in the context of cost. So like we all generally have clients or clients pay the bills, and sometimes they're unwilling to pay certain bills. So we adopt a cost-based approach. But I actually think like I try to think of it differently for civil litigation and investigations and criminal or regulatory investigations. Because in civil litigation, I think cost is a really good proxy for some of the discussion around proportionality. Is this task too large in order to justify the cost of it? But I don't think that carries across that well into the investigatory world or into the criminal white collar crime or regulatory investigation space, because you know, if you're investigating alleged sexual harassment in a company, the cost of the investigation is kind of irrelevant, really. Yeah. It's certainly not as big a factor as it would be in your traditional civil litigation, where it's kind of adversarial, one company suing another company. I don't know, Chris, what are your thoughts?
No, I totally agree with you. In the US, you do have the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Rule 26 does actually talk about proportionality. And in that case, with civil litigation, you do have a cost-benefit analysis to understand essentially what the court needs to weigh the case and the importance of the information and the burden behind it. And so you definitely are able to kind of leverage more of that proportionality in that those types of matters. But if you're dealing with a regulatory matter or an investigation, you know, that kind of goes out the window because you do have certain priorities that you do have to meet. And if you are dealing with regulatory agencies, you may not have a choice. So I know one of the key developments in the US is the FTC and the DOJ just revised their HSR guidelines, which does require more data and documents to be produced as part of their filings. And that's just something we do have to meet.
Yeah, that position is quite similar on this side of the Atlantic. Certainly, now Ireland is probably lags the US in terms of its enforcement of white collar crime and regulatory investigations, but more and more of our regulators have bigger and bigger teeth, and they're starting to bear them more regularly. And again, they're far less sympathetic to the financial challenges that some of our clients may have complying with them than, you know, maybe a judge might be in a civil dispute.
Yes. One other thing too is even in civil litigation, technology tends to be that great equalizer. So, you know, the use of technology and how that changes the cost ramifications of going through discovery, it does change. So if you look at, you know, how much a gigabyte for processing was 15 years ago versus how much it is now, it has dramatically changed, especially if you think about the explosive nature of the amount of data that you do have. So it's one of those things that it you are looking at it, and you kind of have to weigh it against the matter you're on. And then it's also even just the fact that, are you trying to understand, proportionality in terms of volume, but then also trying to understand maybe is it more reasonable to collect certain data sources that are kind of just overly burdensome because the other technology to collect it is just not there yet either. So if you can't automate that process.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. I do think sometimes there's perhaps lawyers, and I say one as one, are guilty sometimes of thinking of proportionality as this single sort of tool that we use to either in scope or descope data sources or custodians. And I think like something that we do quite a lot is we try to like adopt a data centric approach. So, generally any investigation and dispute, not all parties involved in it are equal in terms of importance. And what might be proportionate to one data source may not be proportionate to all data sources. So, like certainly what we've had some success when trying to narrow stuff and the other side contesting it is being reasonably inclusive for the kind of key players in the dispute, and then being a bit more, narrow in what we do with other sort of players' data. And at least that way you're kind of saying, look, I accept that, for the key decision makers or key sort of actors in this dispute or investigation, we're actually going to go belt and braces. But for everyone else, we're going to take a light touch approach. And I think a lot of the time that's probably the correct approach, because I think sometimes when you treat all data equally, that's where proportionality becomes really problematic, because you end up with so much hay and not, it's so difficult to find the needles.
I totally agree. So like exactly, if you have 30 custodians, but then only five of them are the higher priority or have more of the richness of data relevant to the matter itself, you would want to prioritize those five custodians. And even with the data sources too, it may shift, because you have things with email where it's okay to collect the email, but then now that you're dealing with things like hyperlinked documents and modern attachments, and if you don't have a good way of collecting those, then is that now overly burdensome to kind of address those?
Yeah, and I think your very interesting point around the like what certainly my experience is, while the technology for narrowing data sets has gotten immeasurably better, it's at best keeping pace with the growth of the data sets. I would say arguably even like lagging a little. So a lot of the gains you get don't feel as big as they maybe would have in the kind of 2 years ago, 5 years ago, because you're just dealing with so much more data or so many more different types of technical problems, like you're mentioning there, the kind of the ghost links or the ghost links in chat messages or chat message formats or emojis or all these sorts of problematic data types, where now the kind of we'll take the box of files behind your desk and your mailbox sort of days are almost gone. And it's like a lot of the proportionality we apply is de-scoping data sources on the basis that they're too burdensome to collect or unnecessary to collect.
Agreed. It seems like life was a lot more simpler than dealing with discovery than it is now.
That's a really interesting point, because in my experience, a lot of times when my clients or lawyers are wielding proportionality, it's to get them out of doing something that they don't really want to do, not necessarily because it's burdensome or we can't do it, because they just because they don't want to go down that path, like forensically collecting mobile phones, for example. I've lost count of the number of times I've seen someone say, well, we're not going to do that because it's not proportionate, and it's more of a sort of a blunt instrument that's being used to get rid of that line of inquiry and that line of, data, rather than being considered in the context of the case. Because that's what my understanding is from listening to you guys. You have to consider the proportionality of what you're doing, but it's always got to be in context of the particular matter and what you're doing and the type of work that you're undertaking. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd certainly share that experience. And I know you and I, Rachel, have had this issue come up before where clients are very slow to hand over mobile devices. I also think in the EU, it's worth kind of bearing in mind that our privacy laws are a lot, more employee focused and employee friendly. And general employment laws are very employee friendly, certainly in Ireland compared to the US. So it, unless it's a company device, it can be very problematic trying to get. And sometimes I think the proportionality there is very little got to do with the data and very much got to do with not wanting to deal with the legal can of worms involved, asking 10, 15, 20 employees to hand over all that personal data. And I think, in fairness, most of their concerns tend to be legitimate. It's not necessarily that there's a whole pile of, silver bullets on their mobile phone. It's more that their, family photos are, and their text messages with their significant other are, and they just don't want to hand over everything. So again, when what we found best with mobile phone collection sometimes is we collect it, extract what we need, and just delete everything. And people tend to be much happier with that. But they almost want to actually see you delete it, which is very different to their approach to every other data source you collect.
I agree with that too. I think even in the US, there's still that challenge of whether or not you have a company-owned device or whether or not it is a privately owned device. And then what does the BYOD policy state, the bring your own device policy for that company, state of what is expected should you actually get into litigation? So I think that that's still something that continues to evolve and trying to understand. And then you also have to factor in, just to kind of burden to that custodian and the, obviously taking a phone for quite some time, which does impact, their day-to-day responsibilities. And that does go a long way. And then you also have to factor in now some of the technologies that are out there that do allow you to passively remotely collect mobile devices and maybe not collect everything, but be able to target specific messages too. So, it's one of those things that you have to have a keep a pulse on in terms of what the newer technologies allowing you to collect, but then still being cognizant about the privacy laws and just, or the relationship of your custodians to the company itself too.
Yeah. The other thing I always think that's worth focusing on when we're thinking about these issues are like the nature of the investigation or dispute. It's like if it's certainly something like, for example, a white collar crime investigation or, a criminality investigation, where kind of email is sufficiently immature an application that it's everywhere and everyone can't get away from it. So it's very unlikely you'll find anything that shouldn't be in there in terms of criminality these days. Like I'm old enough to remember the days when people used to send very incriminating emails. They tend to have wised up to a greater extent now. But where you still might find that is in a WhatsApp or, a Facebook Messenger post or like the kinds of communications that people are just by their nature still more casual in. I think most people have learned not to be that flippant with work email addresses.
I totally agree. And, one of the things that is helpful a lot of times too is creating that data map and that inventory of the data sources of what you're discovering as you go through your custodian interviews and, making sure that you're really highlighting what's truly relevant in this case. A lot of times you may work with a tech company that has a variety of different software platforms that they use. But which ones are they really using that are pertinent to the matter at hand? And so, rather than collecting every single, from every single platform, which ones do you really have to work off of? And you have at least, some documentation to back that up as well. And then, that kind of goes even forward towards your ESI orders and what protocols are you actually agreeing to with the other side? So, depending on what side you're on, if you happen to be, more on the defense, maybe you want to make sure that you meet and confer over a lot of a variety of different sections versus if you were the requesting party or the plaintiff, then maybe I do want to have you be obligated to preserving and collecting from a variety of different sources that I may or may not have already identified.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think it's one point that sometimes causes proportionality issues in Irish in cases and investigations is much of the engagement around categories tends to predate data mapping. It's just that a quirk of our system that people are often agreeing to categories without really knowing how large the data sets involved in them are. And it necessitates you invariably having to go back and have subsequent conversations when you realize actually it's way larger than we thought, and we don't think this is proportionate or doable in the time frame that we have.
It's true. And I think that especially with some of the newer technologies too, maybe not as new so much now, but with short message formats, that has a highly volatile way of growing. And so, there was one situation where we had about 1 gigabyte of a JSON file that grew into about a terabyte and a half after it was RSMF processed. No one could have seen that coming, but now you're thinking about it, you're like, how are we supposed to get through this? So it's you do have to kind of consider that, especially with the nature of some of the data sources you're dealing with.
Is it fair to say that the earlier in the case or in the matter that you're dealing with data and investigating what you've got, the easier it is to head off proportionality concerns?
I certainly think so. I always think, early and often engagement is generally the best kind. I think also kind of trying to understand like where the discovery obligations fit into the general case strategy or case piece, because there are some cases where it is a burden that adds little value to one or both sides. It's just something that you have to do, but really the facts that are in dispute aren't really that disputed. It's more ultimately going to turn on the decision of a judge. There are other kinds of cases, your fraud cases, your deception cases, your mis-selling cases, where the actual meat and bones of the case are what was actually said, the who, what, why, where, when. And I really think with those, understanding that as early as possible really informs your approach to proportionality. And it may change as witness statements get served or with expert reports get filed, because there might be other things that come into evidence that ultimately you were like, oh, we know that's a lie, and we can find some documents that prove it.
No, I agree with that. A lot of prep work goes a long way. And the thing is, if you're able to at least understand the lay of the land, and with the understanding that that landscape itself may evolve, it's still better than getting blindsided and trying to play catch up as you start to learn more and more, in real time. So you're already going to face under discovering more, more situations that you didn't account for. But the thing is, if you can do some prep work to get ahead of that, then you're probably better off.
Just for the sake of balance, I did want to ask, do you often see disproportionality in the on the flip side where someone's not making enough effort or collecting enough data? And what would your approach be in that situation?
Short answer, yeah. I think like we certainly in Irish law firms, there's a tendency, we do predominantly defendant work in my firm. We tend to act for the larger entity, the corporate. So, we will obviously have onerous obligations because we've bigger data sets. And sometimes I do think some plaintiffs in particular will take a very light touch approach. And like we have a case at the moment where someone is trying to do that and we're raising an issue with dispute on it. I think fundamentally you need to go back to what is the case about. Because sometimes I think the judges, lawyers, stakeholders, clients, people who are ultimately paying the bill can get a little bit blinded by e-discovery jargon and stuff. But fundamentally, it's like, who are the key people that were involved, and are we getting their stuff? And if not, why not? And I think when you ask someone to explain it in those simple terms, if the answer to why not is because it's going to cost a bit of money and take a bit of time, then generally it's a question of, well, how much money and how much time, and is that proportionate to the issues in dispute? That's certainly my view on it. Now, I'm very coloured coming from a legal background on it. Interested for your thoughts, Chris.
Sure. I think part of it is just collecting the data, and then that's one part, and then being able to process and have it ready for review, and understanding how that differs from actually reviewing the number of documents that are related to the case itself, and whether or not you're actually fulfilling a good faith effort in your discovery process. And so, I think it's one thing for you to collect the right type of data, and then being able to kind of strategically cull it down to getting to that what's potentially responsive, but then are you actually putting a good faith effort in your review itself because if you did even just collect, say, 20 gigs that happened to be about 80,000 documents, yet you only reviewed about maybe 5,000 to 10,000 documents out of 80,000, did you really do a good faith effort? And I think that's the thing, is you want to be able to substantiate that your workflow is defensible and that you can actually stand by your process.
Yeah, the other thought that occurred to me as you were saying there is I think it's always worth reminding the other side's lawyers, if they have them, of their own professional obligations. Because they're kind of sometimes I and look, I've had this challenge with myself with clients over the years where a client doesn't want to do something and you have the difficult message of telling them, well, they have to do it because they're obliged to do it, and I'm obliged under my professional obligations to tell the court if you don't do it. And I think it is useful sometimes having that referee on the pitch in the form of a judge to help maybe get everyone to see sense and to find a compromise. It's interesting though, not to go down a total tangent, but that to that question, Rachel, around whether it's disproportionality of people not doing enough. Certainly a quirk in Irish law historically is people were allowed to plead really broad cases, which led to really large broad discoveries, when in reality, even the smallest bit of effort at the start would have narrowed the issues significantly. And this summer, they're proposing changing how we litigate in order to start doing that. It'll be really interesting to see how that plays out for discovery, because at least in theory, it should be a little bit, as I said earlier, kind of early and often, because you should be brought in at the beginning of a case to really narrow the scope and then add interim bits throughout it, not just for the discovery stage. And I think the US is a bit more developed in that regard anyway than we are over here.
Oh, I think one other thing to consider as well is whether or not you're using technology within your workflow. So, being able to use things like TAR 2.0 and being able to kind of project exactly how many documents you truly have to actually review, and then seeing whether or not you actually meet that projection, and actually having just the statistical evidence to back it up does go a long way, especially if you are having to defend whether or not you did do a good faith effort.
As a final question, and we may have touched on this already when you were talking about your legal obligations as a lawyer, Owen, what are some effective methods of communicating on the topic of proportionality, whether that's with an end client or a legal team? How do you get people to listen to you? Chris, do you want to take that first?
Sure. I think we kind of touched base on that. It's essentially, communicating, being transparent. You do have to kind of weigh how transparent you want to be and how you do approach that, especially as you deal with ESI protocols or any other type of preservation agreements. And so being able to have that out there and making sure that both sides are in agreement. And even if it's about agreeing to meet and confer, should you have to touch base on a certain area. And I think just that alone kind of shows that there is collaboration to the court and that you're willing to work with them through that process. There are certain areas where you have cases that if you are going to use things like TAR or whatnot, that you will actually have like addendums to your ESI order, or actually kind of just weigh it out, and maybe you can have an amicable conversation, a dialogue with the other side, so that way you're not having to fight over it down the road. Then there are the cases where maybe you don't do it, but I think that those are some methods of communicating and just trying to weigh whether or not you think there is a good cost reason basis for you to approach your communication one way or another.
I'd agree with all of that. I think transparency, collaboration, if you can get it, particularly with the other side, is great. The other thing I would add is always when, like, if your client doesn't want to do something and they're trying to tell you it's disproportionate, is to try and invert it and just ask them, would they be happy if the other side weren't willing to do this? Or maybe kind of play out what that looks like for the other side. And oftentimes what I find is, no, I want them to do it, but I don't want to do it. And it's they must do it because that's what the correct thing to do is. But really, do we have to do it because it's going to take too long or cost too much or just be a lot of effort and pain on my organization? And sometimes even just gently nudging your own client or the other side's client into that realization that you can't get one without the other is sort of generally gets people to a place where they're willing to engage and be a bit more collaborative around it.
Well, I think we're just about out of time. So thank you, Chris and Owen, for your time today and for sharing your expertise. I think personally, this has been a really interesting and useful discussion, and I'm sure that everyone in the audience will agree. Please, everyone who is listening, feel free to like or comment on the recording and also to subscribe to ILTA YouTube and ILTA Voices for more of the same. Have a great day, everyone, and thank you to Chris and Owen again.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Owen.